We're also doing this work with Nurali Saidov, who's based in Tajikistan and is funded through USAID. So today I'll talk a little bit about insects and ecosystem services, really the different kinds of roles we see beneficial insects playing, benefiting humans, really. And then I'll follow up with research that I've done on native plant attractiveness to natural enemies in the Midwestern US, and then research that Nurali has really headed up in Central Asia. And then finally, I'll finish with a discussion really about habitat management and its use and potential to address multiple conservation goals. I think today a lot of people have had different focuses within habitat management, and ours is really what kinds of multiple benefits can we get from thinking about native plants instead of some of the other plants that have been used more commonly. So we are pretty familiar with the concept of ecosystem services, I think, by now. In services that insects can provide include pollination, decomposition, and biological control. And biological control is the use of natural enemies such as these predators, aureus and syrphid flies, and also parasitoids, in order to keep unwanted pest populations lower than they would otherwise be. And conservation biological control is really the use of habitat provision to increase the population of those that would already be in the landscape. And so insects need access to alternate hosts of prey, the meat, as the last speaker was talking about, hosts and prey in addition to what their primary host or prey might be. If they have access to shelter in the form of moderated microclimates, especially in crop fields early in the season, in-season refuges during any kind of disturbance, tillage, or any pesticide application, as well as overwintering sites. In addition, if natural enemies have access to food in the form of nectar and pollen or sap or honeydew, they are more likely to have larger populations and be better able to control pest populations. So in habitat management, which is really the use of plant borders and other methods in cropping systems to provide those resources to insects, exotic plants have commonly been used, and the four most common species are shown here: alyssum, Lobularia maritima, which we've heard quite a bit about today, phacelia, buckwheat, which we've also heard about, and coriander. All of these species have prolific floral displays. They're pretty reliable. It's pretty easy to get a hold of seed or plant sources for them, and they've also clearly been shown to be successful at providing resources to natural enemies. They have a couple downsides. One of those is that they don't enhance native biodiversity, and the second is that they have potential to be invasive in these locations that they're not native to. So the concept here is really that native plants provide a whole set of benefits that are unique, that those other plants can't provide, one of which is possibly providing ecosystem services. Maybe an increased water filtration ability, for example. They can enhance native biodiversity, which clearly a non-native can't do. They can help with recreation of imperiled habitats. So some of these species are now much more rare in the landscape, and really reintroducing these for habitat management could have implications at a landscape scale of making those species less rare. And finally, in Michigan at least, and in the Midwestern US, native plants typically are perennial, and so that leads to increased habitat permanency, potentially greater overwintering sites, and other benefits to additional wildlife. So really, to kind of review that concept, Doug Landis and Steve Ratton and I put out a paper a little while ago, and we did review field studies in habitat management and found that those flowering species, those four annuals that I showed you, showed up over and over again in field studies. And so they've really been well tested. And we really thought that habitat management could actually be expanded to include additional benefits such as biodiversity conservation, ecological restoration, and also human cultural value, so possibly using plants that are of value to local indigenous cultures. And tourism. People want to see, for example, maybe a vineyard with some pretty flowers versus one without. There's some additional benefits that way as well. So now I'll move on to results from a study performed in the Midwestern U.S. with native plants. So in the fall of 2003, we planted 43 native perennials. We got the plant material from a local nursery that produces only native plants with local genotypes. They're about 15 miles from Michigan State University. In 2004, you can see that the plants were growing but not well established, whereas in 2005 they were well established. So I'll show you data today from that 2005 when these perennials were all blooming and well established. I also used and actually had to seed, because all of the non-natives are annual, recommended non-native annuals, really for comparison to look at how these natives matched up with plants that we already know perform well. This was in a block design. You can see here in the lower right, 1 meter by 1 meter area of plant mat material of one species, separated by this mown buffer, and I had five replicates of each species. So here's me with a modified leaf blower sucking up insects, which I did the week before, week of, and week after peak bloom, focusing the sampling on flowers at each of these plots, identified the insects to family, and then also in 2005 sampled insects from that mown grass buffer with really the idea of is it just plant material that's providing maybe a moderated microclimate to insects, or are they potentially actually looking for the floral resources or something related to them on these plants? And so don't bother straining your eyes to read the species names on the left. What is key here is that these black bars each represent the peak bloom period for a species, and we had species blooming all the way from May through October in 2005. Remember, there were 43, so we got some overlap. And because there was such a long period, I broke it into early, mid, and late season blooming plants in order to kind of simplify the analysis and actually take comparable periods of the season. The other thing I would like to point out here is that because we have overlap, which we anticipated, what we really have an opportunity to do here is select the best plants and select plants that are actually blooming throughout the season, but a subset of the ones that we tested. And that was really the goal at the outset. So I'm just going to show you the late season data today. I think some of you may have seen this this portion of the talk before. So on the y-axis is, or on the x-axis is the plant species listed in bloom order. And then on the y-axis is the number of natural enemies per meter squared sample. And this is the average over, it's a per one sample, the average over those three dates that I talked about. And so also the green, solid green bars are the native plant species. In this case, we have Alyssum, which is kind of in the center, here it is, which is the non-native. And then the number of insects in the grass control was relatively constant throughout this period from mid-August to September. And so really what we saw, if you pay attention to the species that had quite a few more natural enemies than just grass, was a set of 10 species, nine of which were native, that had equal or greater natural enemy numbers as that Lobulari maritima alyssum, which we've heard so much about and which has really proven, and again here, proved to be quite attractive to natural enemies. So the other species included horse mint. So these are shown left to right and then moving downward. So horse mint, shown here, ironweed, cup plant, and boneset, which you notice had 200 natural enemies per sample on average. And that was really a snapshot sample. That was me walking up to the plants, backing up insects, and then walking away. So this is really a tremendous number of natural enemies drawn to this resource. Also blue lobelia, that alyssum which I pointed out, pale leaf sunflower, Rydell's goldenrod, showy goldenrod, and New England aster. So all of these plant species had at least 25 natural enemies in a sample, and again, ranging up to 200. So what we got here was quite a few species which performed as well as or greater than the non-native plants which have been used in the past. And we saw similar, though not quite as striking as this boneset, patterns in early and mid-season as well. As far as the insects that were there, quite a few minute pirate bug. Also a large percentage, a quarter of them, were chalcids of various species, as well as, and then the other most common insects included soldier beetles, spiders, dance flies, and some predatory murids, which were also fairly common. So what we got then, and this is from a bulletin which we went on to create, was a short list of plant species, and here their bloom period is shown by that white bar with the yellow as peak bloom. And again, species blooming all the way from May through October. And this list actually, we had a good, better, best key for how attractive they were to both natural enemies and to pollinators. So now I'll talk a little bit about findings that we're currently kind of looking more closely at with a really similar design and concept in Central Asia. So a very different kind of landscape shown here, and also kind of different cropping systems as well. Whereas our plots were mown, they use a scythe to cut the grass. So it's that we're talking about a lot of different resources really available in each location. So there, they have been sweep net sampling over 4 weeks of full and peak bloom. This gentleman on the upper right has been the person that's been doing that sampling. He's their entomologist there on the project. The field site is on the lower right, so you can see it's very similar design with 1 meter squared area and a mown buffer in between. They have 22 native plant species and 4 replicates. And then their insect collection method is a little bit different with kind of neat actually collecting it into this paper. But again, counting and identifying to family. So here what you see, again, in their early season, May through mid-June, with 6 species, a significant difference between plant species and the number of natural enemies at the plant. With these two species, Conium maculatum and Dacus carata, as being the leading species here. Both are in the family Apiaceae, and you might begin to see a theme here. In the mid-season, again, significant difference in attractiveness to natural enemies. And in this case, Coriandrum sativum is on the upper left here. Osimum basilicum and Anethum graveolens were the most attractive plants. I was unable to find a photo of Ziziphora interrupta, but it had similar, at least statistically similar, attractiveness as Osimum basilicum, which is what we know of as basil. So here again, coriander and Anethum graveolens are species which have been shown in the past to be attractive to natural enemies. So this is really kind of reaffirming that finding. And then in the late season, again, I was unable to find a photo of Alcyon nudiflora, so that's what this space is about. Just a reminder to me to say that. So this is Achillea filipendula, Pyrethrum carneum, Mentha asiatica, Impatiens balsamima, and then Fanniculum vulgare, which has also been talked about today, so that's blanking out on the common name, but fennel. And so Achillea filipendulina here and Fanniculum vulgare were the most attractive to natural enemies. Again, a significant difference between plant species. So here we know Fanniculum has been found in the past to be attractive, but here's another new species, Achillea filipendulina, for use in Tajikistan. And so really the results here indicate that there were 7 species that were most attractive to natural enemies. Not too surprisingly, but very interestingly, all are on lists of previously recommended plant species, except for those 2 new ones, A. filipendulina and C. maculatum. Many of these species, in contrast to those in Michigan, are annual and biennial. That is just what was more available there. They actually, whereas I got plants from a nursery, a native plant nursery, and I had them grown for me, they actually went up into the hillside and collected seed, and then propagated it and grew it that season. So just different mechanisms of finding these plants, but that may have also played a role in the annual and biennial. Those potentially could have had more frequent seed production. In addition, in Tajikistan, it's a much drier area. Their growing can only occur with irrigation, so that would kind of lend possibly to plants with shorter life cycles. So what we have now is really a list of most promising species from Central Asia and also from the Midwestern U.S. And so this kind of approach could be repeated elsewhere in order to locate native plants from other regions as well, which are equally or more promising as the plants that we all know and love and we know work for enhancing natural enemy populations. So next I want to talk a little bit about additional benefits of potential benefits of habitat management. In the Midwestern U.S., we historically had two ecosystems, savanna, shown on the upper right, and then prairie on the lower left there, which would have had flowering plants throughout the whole growing season. And what we have now in Midwestern U.S. is quite a fragmented landscape, an abundance of crop fields, and even where we do have strips within those crops, in some cases they're grass, and so they're not providing floral resources. Along roadsides, we have brome grass, which is non-native to the U.S., and a lack of flowering plant species. In some cases, even in home landscaping, there's a lack of flowering plants or a preponderance of non-native flowering plants. So what we could have instead is a roadside that looks more like this. This is a picture taken in western Michigan, or a flowering strip in a crop field which looks more like this, and have additional benefits that are related to conservation of planting these species, including bee conservation and increased pollination services. So really kind of increasing the number of considerations for these plants. Potentially they have thrips, but they also could increase the number of bumblebees, for example. In addition, habitat conservation could be another benefit to using these native plant species. And then native landscaping could also be performed to really increase, again, the occurrence of these species throughout the U.S. again. And again, this bird's a reminder to me that other wildlife can also benefit from these perennial plantings, at least in the Midwestern U.S. And this work is not going to be done with a bunch of scientists, even talking to other scientists at conferences. It requires an interdisciplinary approach. I think it requires collaboration with farmers. We had two farmers. The other image that I showed you was actually a strip we planted at a farmer's field. They were organic growers. I think this has a special potential in the U.S. for organic growers. Native plant producers could also stand to gain from this kind of approach, especially again in the U.S. We've had some success. Some research collaborators of Doug and I have been working with commodity groups and have found quite a positive response from those folks as well. They're working with blueberry growers who have an explicit interest in both controlling natural enemies and assuring that there's effective pollination. And then conservation agencies, both nonprofit and governmental, could also be involved in this, and really with their understanding of the concept could help develop recommendations for farms and other plantings. And then I think an additional step is really putting the word out to the public. So we've developed a website that's this www.nativeplants.msu.edu with a lot of this information available, also information on how to plant these things, how to seed them, so that people can make their own choices, ideally, and incorporate our findings, in their backyard or on their farm. And then also a colleague of mine has put out a really great flipbook on identifying natural enemies, so really introducing people, lay people, to what these insects are, who they eat, and what they look like. A lot of people are surprised at what a ladybug pupa or larva actually looks like. Also, this publication on conserving native bees was put out by collaborators of ours, and then we created this publication on beneficial insects and attracting those with native flowering plants. So again, just really trying to get the word out to people that would actually implement it at locally. So in summary then, insects really can provide valuable ecosystem services in agricultural landscapes. The use of those native plants can provide many advantages. Really, we've called them stacked ecosystem services in the past. and development of locally adapted conservation plannings by teams, including scientists and entrepreneurs and educators, could provide benefits for multiple stakeholders and really encourage the use of these findings. And with that, I'd like to thank a whole host of people that helped with this work, including research collaborators, both farmers and native plant producers, and researchers at Michigan State had support with identification, folks from the Landis Lab for support with completing this research, undergraduate research assistants who, of course, are invaluable, and then a variety of sources for funding support. Thanks for your time. So we have plenty of time for questions, I'm hearing.
we are almost a half hour ahead of schedule, so please, if you have questions, feel free to ask.
Repeat the question.
I noticed that Dacus Kuroda has been so successful in practice, and we found really good results. We've just been looking strictly at a couple of aureus species, and thrips, bisonosa.
It's like you were a plant. So the question is, what are there kind of generalizations that can be made about these plants that are really attractive? And another other work that I did was actually looking at that. I looked at a variety of plant characteristics of these species. I looked at flower color. I looked at corolla shape, depth, and width. So with the idea that maybe insects could or couldn't access nectar or pollen in these species, I looked at floral area. Others today have talked about how the more flowers there are, the more natural enemies there are. I looked at plant height. I think that's it. Bloom period was kind of had to be built into the model because I saw more insects later in the season. And what I found actually was the more floral area, the more insects. That was the with the understanding that as the season went on in this system, there were more natural enemies. That's just part of the way that works.
So.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. They have, and their flowers are often probably pretty easy to find for insects as well, because they tend to be kind of on the top of the plant. So the question is about floral area. Yeah, I just said it, more is better, but could there be another factor coming into play, such as nectar quantity or quality? I actually collected nectar for that. That's kind of one of my things that's on the back burner. What I found, I didn't look at quantity. Quantity is extremely variable according to time of day and weather and plant, whether or not it had been fed on. So I kind of eschewed that whole side of things, but I was looking at sugars within nectar, and I found a pattern. It was that those minute parasitoids were more likely to be at, I think it was fructose-dominated or sucrose-dominated plants. Forgive me for not knowing. I'm doing a different research project now, so that hasn't been on the forefront of what I've been thinking about. But I did think about it, and I think, I was explaining, I think, 40% of the variability or 60% of the variability with those characteristics that I looked at. So there clearly were things that I wasn't measuring that were playing a role as well in insect abundance at the plants. So the question is really surrounding the the perennial habit of these plants and the downsides of that. What I tell people is, you know, I've emphasized the fact that you don't have to go out and buy these plants again, that there's a high initial cost in many cases, but the idea is you're putting them in and you're letting them go, and then you don't have to keep buying them again. And if, you know, if it's something that reseeds, well, it could become a problem in your crop, so maybe you don't want that thing, you know, if it's an annual that reseeds. So that's part of it, but I definitely think that the way farming systems work right now in the U.S., there are some limitations to it because many people are growing Roundup Ready crops, and a perennial strip in the middle of their field just isn't going to survive. I can also say that when we seeded plants at farmers' fields, they were asking us what the heck was going on. You know, that was from seed, and there was a lot of telling them over and over again, I know it doesn't look like anything right now, it's going to be great, you just need to mow it. And so, you know, because that's a group of people who are used to putting in wheat and seeing it come up, or putting in corn and see it come up. And so it is a very different kind of paradigm. And so I think a lot of educating people around that is key.
Do you consider woody perennials? It looks like the button bush there.
So kind of your question is about the potential for longer-lived perennials, maybe shrubby things, maybe even small trees. We thought about that. Definitely part of it was the limitation of that this was a master's project, and so we said, okay, what do we think will bloom within a few years? That was one of the caveats. And so we did have a few shrubby things like buttonbush, which I think actually didn't show up in the, you know, in a lot of the list, but I think over time is more and more attractive. And there are a lot of insects per floral area, but there was hardly any floral area there. So I think that's more a limitation of kind of the length of time we had, but I definitely think there's a lot of potential for including shrubby plants as well in this concept, kind of the hedgerow concept that has been used in Europe. So the question is about the scale that these need to be employed at. I get questions like that all the time when I talk to growers, because of course they want to know how much per field area. A student in my lab is currently looking at landscape effects, whether simple versus complex landscapes have more or less effect when you put in a flowering strip. So she's asking that question. Nobody yet has been asking that question of exactly what area do you need. It's possible that it's enough that without some sort of large incentive, farmers might not be jumping to take that step. Yeah. But yeah, it's still an unanswered question, essentially. Thanks. I also looked at herbivore abundance of these species. I think that part of it depends on what you're trying to grow. What I saw on these plants was quite a bit of Lygus bug, so anything that's going to have a Lygus related problem maybe this may not be a great choice for it. But at the same time, you know, we saw herbivores in the grass. They were somewhat different herbivores, but they're sort of out in the environment anyway. Part of the criteria for choosing those plants that I showed you, especially the ones in Midwestern U.S., was do they have more natural enemies than herbivores? Is the benefit outweighing the potential cost? That's really how I think about it. But yeah, of course, you can get into increasing complexity with it. That's a great question. I know aureus is native, right? So that's a large percentage of what we saw. As far as coccinelles, we saw a mixture. I didn't see a strong pattern either way with native versus non-native coccinelles going to native versus non-native plants. I did not identify those minute parasitoids to species, so I'm not sure which were native and not. The spiders, I'm pretty sure, were native, just because I don't know of any non-native spiders that have been introduced. trying to think of other insects. I kind of thought about that initially. I don't think that there's a really strong pattern between native plants attracting native natural enemies and non-native plants attracting non-native natural enemies. Yeah.
Do you have any sense how well these plants might offer local habitats for some of the critters
you're looking at? I know that I saw lady beetle pupae on some of the plants. You know, I know that the insect abundance increased year by year, and I know that in part that's because of flowering, floral area increasing. My sense is, this is just my sense, right? Is that with perennial strips, the abundance of beneficials could really be greatly increased because of the overwintering sites versus something that is disturbed every year.
If there are any questions for any of the other speakers, or if you know Felix or Rami or anybody has anything more that they would like to say, you know, now's the time to start in 15 minutes.
Yeah. Thanks. Is there another
yes.
Question?
Yeah. Felix.
So the question is, do certain groups of natural enemies gravitate toward certain species? And I don't recall offhand, unfortunately. I can't think of a... faba bean had... Vicia faba had a lot of lady beetles, but I think that was in part because there was an aphid population on that plant. So I saw a couple plants like that that I think had more of a resident population of natural enemies because they were feeding on other resources that were there. Can't think of any others offhand. That's a great question.
I had a question for Rami.
What's your name?
Thanks.
So the question was,
what rate of sweet elizabeth
have to you know, it every grower does something different. Growers are very independent minded, and so they generally, especially when it's something kind of new, they generally do it the way they feel is best, and whatever information they're getting. I guess the way we settle on is sort of depending on what level of how high a degree the problem is. Like if it's a very severe pest, then we allocate more land towards the problem, towards our beneficial habitat, and basically as much as we can afford.
Would there be like a range? Somebody might do just one strip per 20-acre field, and other people might do 10 strips?
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah. And whether you do them, like there's some growers that do them permanently, you know, they'll just, and they're not necessarily using the best permanent plant in that situation. And then there's some that will plant prior to putting their crops in. So there there's different plants. So even we're using other habitat plants besides the alyssum too. So it kind of depends on location and and time of year.
Felix.
Yeah, I had a question about the interesting result that you presented, that there seems to be negative interaction between pollen and nectar availability on orioles.
That's correct, yes. Well, I guess I'd ask you. Yeah, I don't have a good explanation. I think physiologically, I guess it doesn't really make too much sense. I'm not sure. Like having an additional food source, you wouldn't think it would make you smaller, but that's kind of what the results show. The artificial nectar was placed basically in the same location as the extra floral nectary, and then the pollen was all over the leaf.
Could it have been the artificialness of the nectar?
It was honey, and I think. The honey source we used was not. I know I've talked to insectary growers that have used honey they think might have like insecticide residues or something, but in this situation, I'd have to go back and review, but I think it's the same source as the pollen, which is from like this natural area on the coast. So I think that's kind of, I guess you can't rule that out as a possibility.
I'd just like to make a comment with respect. You said you got pollen from beekeepers, right?
Yeah, from one beekeeper,
okay.
Yes.
I have tried using that in my studies, and when the bees put the pollen on, there's something from the saliva that keeps it in the I forget what it's called. Anyway, we found that it's, even if you dilute it with water and try and spray it, it's not as good as fresh collected pollen.
Uh-huh.
There's something in the saliva that adversely affects the quality of the pollen, and shouldn't use it.
Huh. Yeah. Well, yeah, no, I guess it makes it even more surprising than that we, because that was, I mean, the nectar really didn't just have much of an effect, but yeah, no, I guess it's bees are much better at collecting pollen than humans, though. I don't know. I guess I have another question. I know you mentioned Phacelia, I guess for the Midwest it's not a native, right? Yeah. But I mean, it is a native to North America. And I know we've used that, and it seems like you said, natural enemy wise, there seems like surfaces, they're all natives. They don't care whether it's an introduced plant or not. But I know like with Phacelia, you get a lot of native bees that use it, that they don't visit any other plants we use.
Yes, there's definitely more of a possibility.
So any ideas why the discrepancy, I guess?
I think that the bee-flower relationship is much more
co-evolved, don't you think?